Welcome again. We're here with professional risk analyst Gordon Phillips. You can find us at riskandreality.com. Today we're looking ahead along the timeline for the so-called Great Reset. Conventional wisdom suggests a target date of 2034 for the transition to a life that might include a digital currency in 15-minute cities. The good news here is that we still have a few years to prepare and strategize for what lies ahead. And Gordon, as the chief risk officer for a hedge fund, does it matter what happens at these annual Davos conclaves?
No, we just make money. The software that we use is a wonderful little robot. It's a wonderful machine that just chews equity out of the international forex market, irrespective of what these crazies and psychopaths do in Davos. Matter of fact, the crazier the world gets and the more the market bounces up and down, the easier it is for the software to extract profit.
We're going to begin here by discussing economist Martin Armstrong and what his Socrates forecasting system sees for us here in the U.S. over the next 5 years. Socrates is a software system that has a rather astonishing record at predicting events that have actually shaped history. It uses an algorithm based on the assumption that there is a natural rhythm to events based on 8.6-year cycles. We'll get into this more deeply in a moment. But first, Gordon, let's talk about Armstrong. Here's what Wikipedia says about him. It says Martin Armstrong is an American economic forecaster who was convicted of a felony for investment fraud. He served 11 years in jail for a Ponzi scheme that cheated investors out of $700 million and also hid $15 million in assets from regulators. Your thoughts, Gordon?
Yes, indeed. Well, let's begin at the beginning, a very good place to start. Martin Armstrong did not ever defraud investors. Martin Armstrong is a true genius. Now, I don't adulate human beings. I don't put anybody up on a pedestal. But to the extent that anyone is deserving of respect based on their life history and what they've accomplished, this guy certainly is. Martin Armstrong was a millionaire by the time he was in his late teens through his passion in investing and trading rare coins. When I say rare, I mean I'm talking from Mesopotamia and Greece and Rome, you know, that kind of ancient and rare. He became the largest hedge fund manager in the world, trading a multi-trillion dollar hedge fund, which at the time was about 50% of the entire United States GDP. As a result, he befriended all of the heads of governments all over the world, and he was incorruptible, like the old Elliot Ness on the Untouchables TV series. He couldn't be bought. His advice was sought by everybody, all the international hedge funds, major corporations. I mean, he knows everybody. He was personal friends with Margaret Thatcher when she was the Prime Minister of Great Britain. He developed the world's first truly artificial intelligence computer. And what he did was he had his staff feed it with all the available data on almost everything you can think of on planet Earth. I mean, it could be ancient Sumerian records of interest rates being charged. I mean, a mind-boggling amount of information. And he fed it into the computer and he taught it to think for itself. And it generates reports that are absolutely prophetic and stunning. He also did this combined with his understanding of embedded natural mathematical cycles that exist in our creation and our reality that are totally real, that are unknown to the public. You touched on one of them, 8.6 years. There's many of those cycles. They're all ultimately based on pi, believe it or not. Good old 3.14159, you know, the ratio between the circumference of a circle and its diameter. So his computer started forecasting events like the collapse of the Soviet Union, and sometimes years in advance. So imagine it's the early 1980s and your computer says that on a certain day, the stock market's going to crash. Everybody thinks you're completely bonkers. And then it happens. And the whole world goes, oh my God. And then he does it again and again and again. And then the Central Intelligence Agency comes along and says, we would please like the code to your software. He says, no, thank you. And they say, well, you have to give it to us. And he says, no, I don't. And then they trump up these absurd charges and end up charging him with contempt of court which under the cruel and unusual punishment clause in the Constitution has been deemed to be no more than 6 months. In other words, you can't traditionally hold someone in contempt of court for more than six months. I mean, that's been the pattern in the U.S. They held him for 7 years without ever bringing charges in a maximum security lockdown prison right in the middle of Manhattan. The public doesn't even know it's there, just this obscure looking building. And he was several attempts on his life were made. He was in a coma. He published an underground newsletter the entire time he was there. And when he came out, he thought the whole world will have forgotten about me. He put on his first World Economic Conference, WEC, and you couldn't get in the room. The line went down the block and the entire back row was seated with representatives of every one of the world's top central banks. Okay? That's who this guy is. Very, 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 very compelling. His future can never be guaranteed. But to the extent that anyone has an astonishing track record, he certainly earns the gold star, the brass ring, whatever you want to call it. So there you go.
Tell me about Socrates, his economic forecasting model, and fit it right into the context of what we are going through now and what we should expect the next 10 years.
Well, for years, he forecast the war would start, and not just start, but start in Ukraine. And his computer projects the complete dissolution of the United States into various territories, which is what it also forecast with regard to the Soviet Union. And I think it was December 31st, 1991, Boris Yeltsin stood on a tank in the square in Moscow with a bullhorn urging Soviet soldiers not to shoot on their own, not to fire upon their own citizens. And they did. They didn't. They did not. That was the beginning of the end. Within a year, the entire Soviet Union fell apart and reverted to the aggregated states that had been all cobbled together back, you know, under this, under Soviet control 50 years ago. So the computer, to answer your question, this computer forecasts the dissolution of the United States, a major civil unrest, the possibility of such political conflict and turmoil that there may not be a presidential election. And of course, all the mayhem and chaos in the market, to the dollar, to the stock market that goes along with that. And it is putting the date of 2032 as its target for the low point. And then after that, there'll be a rebirth, a growing again of prosperity, where a new whatever, okay, I don't know if we call it America, America 2.0, the new America, whatever, emerges from that mess and things start to look better again. The question is, what form of government will that look like? And today's youth will be running it. The quality of education being what it is, one can only hope that there'll be enough really smart, well-educated people to lead the future in both the public and private sectors into something resembling liberty, free markets, and prosperity at that time.
I want to play devil's advocate with you here. You basically said things are going to take a turn for the better. Let's talk about the people at Davos. They make the laws. They have the guns. They run the banks. They own the media. Would we expect that 10 years from now, they're going to just lay it all down and walk away and cooperate? How do you reconcile the present position of power they have with what you think will present itself in 10 years?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that his computer is saying that. You asked me what Socrates is saying. Now you're trying to guess how it could come about that that would be true. Assuming that it's correct and that is true, it would only come about because the people of the world would rise up. Now, whether you know, the paradigm is of the citizens with a pitchforks and shovels, you know, and baseball bats. I think today it'd be more like a smartphone in one hand and a TV remote in the other, marching out in the streets. But that eventually the people will rise up. I mean, you know, these super elite, these multinational, supranational psychopaths are what they're 0.01% of the entire world's population. They're very badly outnumbered. There was a great movie by Disney called A Bug's Life. Really, really great clip in it where the grasshoppers are the superior civilization, and the ants are their slaves, their serfs and servants. And there's a scene in it where one little ant rises up and the grasshopper general says to his underlings, he says, "You fools, don't you understand what'll happen if this catches on?" Great paradigm, great metaphor, I should say. But that would be the only possible explanation, because if the current course of events turns into a true digital concentration camp and we end up with something that looks like the movie THX-1138, are you familiar with the movie THX-1138?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, George Lucas' very first feature film right out of college, years before Star Wars. It features some very prominent movie actors. And it depicted this kind of dystopian future in which the men and women all looked the same. Everyone had a shaved head and wore white tunics, and the lighting was all kind of sterile and fluorescent, and they were all on some form of government-prescribed medication, and where your only value as a human being was your debit-credit relationship vis-a-vis the central computer. And that's about where we're heading in China, with the United States to follow soon thereafter. But the end of the movie, if you'll recall, had a wonderful burst of freedom. The very end of the movie was very, very positive and uplifting. It's a minor spoiler giveaway there, but a cult classic, THX-1138. Robert Duvall was one of the actors in the movie. Just a very, very classy movie. So, did that answer your question? That was a bit of a digression, I suppose.
Okay, now we've seen the emergence of autonomous parallel economies in response to the centralized control imposed by the 2020 COVID lockdowns. We've seen politically aligned conservative businesses and networks emerge. We've seen the freelance gig economy arise as a buffer against unemployment. We've also seen barter and community networks take shape. Do you think these parallel economies can take root in the face of more centralized control by the powers that be?
Well, there have always been parallel economies, always, throughout history. The question is, who's got the guns? If I've got the guns, I can make you use my money. And then I can deem your money to be illegal, and I can criminalize the use of your money. I can call what you do participating in the underground economy, quote unquote, the black market. Now, do you know what that really is? Do you know what the underground economy really, truly is?
Well, if you read Wikipedia, if you take them at their word, it's a set of illegal activities.
Absolutely.
Which I would think is not really fair at all.
Well, what it really is where consenting adults exchange goods and services of their own free will, absent any type of coercion or regulation. If you and I meet out behind the barn and I've got a bunch of chicken eggs and you got a bunch of firewood, and we agree that the number of eggs I give you is equal in value to the number of pieces of firewood you give me, we both smile, we nod, we shake hands. Might be hard to shake hands with an armful of chicken eggs and firewood, but you get my point. Neither one of us has been harmed. Neither one of us has taken advantage of the other person. Neither one of us has increased our value or net worth. We've simply exchanged the type of substance that we deem to be of equal value with the other person. There is no taxation. There are no fees being taken out. Nobody's watching. There are no lawyers, no tax collectors, just two people having a nice day, helping each other out. That is the, quote, underground economy, and it cannot be tolerated by the people who run the monetary systems of the world. But there have always been underground economies. When this country was first founded as a nation, young Alexander Hamilton, who George Washington appointed as his Secretary of the Treasury and who had been his aide-de-camp during the Revolution, Washington was getting on in years and didn't understand the nuances of finance, as Thomas Jefferson himself wrote in his later years in some letters to friends. And so Alexander Hamilton wanted to show we the people that this new boss that had just been created, the federal government, was the new king. And so some very nice people in Pennsylvania, the Whiskey Rebellion, the good people, the farmers, the town folks, whiskey was one of their main currencies. It was, they would barter with it. It was a form of liquid gold. It was what sustained their local economies. And Hamilton wanted to put a tax on whiskey as being a sin tax, so to speak. I don't mean S-Y-N, I mean an S-I-N, quote unquote, a sin tax. And the people, they didn't want to pay it. And so Hamilton marched out with a whole bunch of federal troops to put down the whiskey rebellion. That was the beginning of the decline of this republic in its first year. The people weren't allowed to be free. They weren't allowed to exchange goods and services without Uncle Sam stomping in and give me my share of the booty. Give me my cut of the action here. Got to get some taxes going. I mean, thus has history always been. And so there have been parallel economies everywhere on this planet. There are right now. When Venezuela collapsed, or the collapse began a few years ago, it's still in pretty bad shape. The young people of Venezuela, by young, I mean anybody probably under 20 plus, created their own economy. And they did it they'd go down an alley in a city in Venezuela, and they'd find a place where there was some broken cement between a couple of bricks in the alley. And they would take a thumb drive and they would stick it in there so that the business end was pointing out. And then they would kind of cement it in place. And you walk down the alley and you just take your laptop and you go boop sideways, you stick it in there, you upload or download something, you walk out. They created their own physical internet that couldn't be traced or tracked. And they were exchanging money with each other in the form of cryptocurrency tokens. Didn't need any internet, didn't need any electricity. There's your parallel economy. I'm sure that was illegal, but you can't stop people from doing these things. As a matter of fact, given what's coming with central bank digital currency, at some point, I have no doubt that the United States government is going to ban cash. I mean, ban it completely, like it goes out of circulation. In the way I would do it, you don't want to ban things. It gets people all upset. What you do is, as bills wear out, the lifespan of a $1 bill is only a few months, as I recall. It gets handled so much. It just gets tattered and frayed, and the banks send them back in truckloads back down to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, and they get shredded. You can go down there and go to the tourist lounge, and you can buy a jar of shredded $100 bills. You put them on your coffee table. But that's what I would do. I would just let them gradually go out of circulation until there aren't any left. Of course, you could easily just criminalize and ban the 100s. You could say you've got a month to turn them in. Well, flush out a lot of tax money too. But that's what Europe did with the 500 euro note not too many years ago. And then you're down to just having your entire financial life is on your smartphone. Your whole world becomes one big giant QR code. And at that point, I would imagine that people who kept cash, physical cash, probably $20 bills would be optimal. And I'm talking, a whole boxes full of them in the basement. They wouldn't be able to be used above ground in commerce, having been banned and criminalized. But they'd be darn handy as barter tokens. I mean, they're very durable. You know, that paper that they print the Federal Reserve note on, all denominations, is made by a company called Crane and Company outside of Worcester, Massachusetts. Very highly guarded, heavily armed federal facility guarded by the U.S. Department of the Treasury. That's where they make the very special rag linen paper on which all of their American money is printed. It's very durable, and it would last for quite a while, and it might be a good idea. So these are just some of the things that people are going to have to start thinking about to prepare for what's coming. But back to you.
Now, arguably the leading voice in the anti-digital currency awareness movement is Catherine Austin Fitz. She's credible because she's a former insider. She was former assistant secretary of housing with Bush 41. And she has put forth a 9-point plan for how we, the people, can fight back against the digital currency. Point number one, her first suggestion is to use cash, move away from plastic, use cash. Her second is to nurture analog.
And by that, she means we want a healthy balance of digital and analog transaction options. What we do not want is an all-digital system, whether it is CBCs or all other digital mechanisms. Some digitization is both healthy and efficient, but in all digital system with regards to virtual anything is vulnerable to central control and manipulation. Your thoughts?
Well, it's a gray area. I mean, where do you draw the line between too much digitization and too little analogization? In other words, we're analog human beings. You know, those two people who met out behind the barn and exchanged eggs for firewood, that was an analog transaction, right? There's no blockchain. As soon as something is digitized, it can be stored, cloned, transmitted, and used for surveillance purposes. So my response to what she said, and I'm not disagreeing with her, would be use the digital world to the absolute minimum extent possible to still be able to function and look normal to your friends and neighbors and to the nice teller ladies at the bank.
Okay, number three, seek integrity. In other words, transact with people of integrity, even if to do so appears to cost more. In the end, fraudsters and others who contribute to unhealthy systems through their own greed or lust for power cause untold losses. All these little expenses related to transaction with integrity can end up being lifesavers if the alternative is you having assets in Madoff or Lehman Brothers. Your comment on that?
Well, I agree. You have to be educated. You have to be discerning. You have to be astute. Know who you're doing business with. Do your background research. You'll vet the situation. If it's local, you know who you can trust. If you're dealing with friends and neighbors in your community, you know the people who appear quote unquote sketchy and the people who are forthright, upright, and solid citizens, so to speak. So there's not much to be said on that beyond just keep your eyes open. Situational awareness is always very helpful.
Okay. Another one of our recommendations, bank at an intimate scale. In other words, find a good, well-managed local bank or a credit union for your banking business. Talk to your bankers, get to know them, educate them about the dangers of a central bank digital currency. And I have been rather surprised when I was at my credit union a few months ago and I talked to a loan officer who did not know what a bank run was. So this is something that does have its place, developing a relationship and talking to the people you do your banking business with. Your thoughts?
Well, it's well-meaning. She's a nice lady, but it's not practical in the long run, because if you want to be in a regulated, licensed bank, whether it's a member of the Federal Reserve System or a credit union, your license can be yanked if you don't play ball with the big boys. So I would say it could be delayed for as long as possible. But eventually, everybody is going to have to participate with at least one toe in this digital bathtub, to use the bathing analogy. And, you know, sure, you can educate your local bank officials to what's coming. And what are they going to do about it? Nothing. Nothing they can do about it. They might be willing to wink, nod, and turn the other way once in a while if you don't have all your papers and ducks lined up. But they're not going to do anything that's going to create a criminal culpability for them or liability for the bank. But to the extent that you deal with a credit union, I would agree with that as opposed to a regular quote unquote bank. But the larger picture, I think, is to deal with the banking system as little as light and as lightly as possible. In other words, just enough to have enough money in the bank to be able to cover and float the rotating cycle of income and expenses that occur on a monthly basis, and that every other electron that you've got to your name beyond that be in some form of hard asset, which you totally own and control, and which is not simultaneously a debt liability of a third party who can intervene and step in between you and your money and decide whether or not you can have it.
Okay, number five, finance your friends, not your enemies. Start reducing your number of online and digital financial transactions and evolve away, whenever possible, from relying on or investing in fintech or credit card companies that are financing and promoting digital IDs, vaccine, health passports, central bank digital currencies.
Yeah, I agree. You're talking about getting out of the system, quote unquote. Trying to get one leg out of the system before they slam the digital door shut, which is what they're going to do. And there are a lot of people who are doing this right now. They're stocking up on core supplies. They're learning how to make their own ointments and salves and different types of medications at home themselves and not have to rely upon a failing medical system. They're developing barter networks locally with people in their community. They're putting together associations of tradespeople who have different skills that they can rely on. You know, if you'll come over and do some carpentry in my house, I'll homeschool your kids and we'll shake hands and that'll be the end of it. This is what's happening. It's almost reverting to a more agrarian form of society pre-computer digital information age revolution of necessity, because people just are sick and tired of being surveilled in every single thing they do, having their every transaction, movement monitored and recorded. I mean, this conversation right now, every conversation you've ever had on a smartphone, every text you've ever sent, every email you have ever sent or received has been recorded and is in fact stored by the United States government, National Security Agency. I remember watching a special on the Discovery Channel back in the 90s. This is 30 years ago. And it was showing recent technological developments at the U.S. Department of the Postal Service and how they had new efficient processes for flipping through, you know, just billions of letters every day and all different size. And how could they possibly read people's handwriting? This was optical recognition was in its infancy, but it had, you know, no matter how you printed someone's name and address on an envelope, it had to be able to recognize it in all of its zillions of variations. And one of the things that they said casually on this documentary, which the person being interviewed didn't comment on, it just kind of went by, was a camera was taking an optical graphical snapshot of every single piece of mail traveling through the U.S. postal system. Every single piece of mail was being photographed and that data was being stored. So they would have a permanent record of who was corresponding with whom. That was 30 years ago. Okay. So, you know, if you want to, you can be free to the extent that you're willing to be inconvenienced and to try to get out of the debt, credit, money, cyber surveillance system. And then really what it looks like is more like what America looked like back in 1950 and 1960.
Okay, we've got another one here. Support state officials who support financial freedom. Ask your state legislators to start a sovereign state bank like the Bank of North Dakota to protect your right to free financial transactions. Make sure it's a sovereign bank that supports and does not and cannot compete with private community banks and credit unions. Your thoughts?
Well, to the extent that such a bank could be completely isolated and insulated from the federal system, in other words, truly a bank that existed and functioned only within the state, would not accept funds transfers into or out of it from out of state, and only serve to service the people of that state under the 10th Amendment, the federal government would have no jurisdiction whatsoever. When I presented to the Free State Project 10 years ago, when it was still in its infancy here in the state of New Hampshire, I encouraged its leaders to create a new currency in the state of New Hampshire to be used, to be able to be put into circulation along with federal government money, that the Federal Reserve note, the so-called dollar. And I explained to them that until the state of New Hampshire isolated itself and insulated itself economically from the general economy, that they would always be in the same boat with everybody else. In other words, if everybody is transacting and buying and spending and earning and saving in dollars, and the dollar is constantly depreciating, being debased, you're going to go down with everybody else. So I said, there has been a whole history of community currencies that have exploded all over the world. For example, in Ithaca, New York, back in the 1980s, I think it was, be like 40 years ago, they created a local currency called the hour, H-O-U-R, the Ithaca hour. And they deemed it to be equal in value to a $10 bill at that time, $10 Federal Reserve note. And it was a very nice piece of work. It was beautifully printed with anti-counterfeiting devices. And they introduced it into the local economy as a kind of solidarity currency, almost like sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce, that when you use this currency, you're supporting local businesses here in Ithaca. But the underlying agenda was to boycott the Federal Reserve System and its usury-based fractional reserve system in that area by driving it out, by replacing it instead with a local currency-based, a community-based currency. Well, the FBI came in and investigated. The Secret Service came in and investigated. The Treasury Department, the IRS, they all said, hey, that's fine. We don't care. Go ahead. You can exchange bottle caps for all we care. Just make sure that you write it all down because you owe the income tax on your gains, no matter in what form they're being paid. Other than that, have a nice day. Well, then in Western Massachusetts, in the Berkshire Mountains, they created Berkshares. Those are still circulating today. This idea went all over the world. And all over the world, there's still communities doing that to this day, where they're basically boycotting the fiat debt money system by bartering in their own local community currencies. That's what I said to the Free State Project. I said, you guys ought to create a beautiful looking intaglio press, I mean, just a high quality piece of anti-counterfeited currency and beautiful, nice colors and light shifting ink and the embedded little laser tags, all the kind of stuff you see in today's money. But put a picture of Daniel Webster, the great orator, in the middle of it. He was from New Hampshire. And maybe put a porcupine up in each corner, the state animal of New Hampshire. And then maybe have it circulate at a 1 or 2% discount to the Federal Reserve note. It's a reverse sales tax. You would create New Hampshire as the most economically free place on the planet. It would become the new Switzerland in America. Right now, you're trying to attract libertarian-minded families from all over the United States to move into New Hampshire, which they're doing, to their credit. It's a very slow process, but they would come pouring in waves. People would come into New Hampshire as fast as they could get here if they knew that the economy in the state of New Hampshire was 100% insulated from the destruction that's going to be coming from the rest of the economy. And they all looked at me like I had three heads and said, thank you, but no thank you. And then didn't invite me to come back and present the following year. So there you go.
Another suggestion she has is to start a state bullion depository. So her contention is, in a worst case scenario, you can use your gold and silver as a local currency. What do you think of that?
Why would I want any government in any way, shape, or form, from local dog catcher up to the governor, to be holding my gold in their vault? And I have to go over there and ask them if I can please have it, touch it, look at it, juggle it, drop it on my foot, or spend it. Why would I want to do that?
I agree. And she also puts a qualifier on it saying, in a worst case scenario. In a worst case scenario, that's the last place you want to have it. And what's that saying? It's really been used quite a bit these last few years. Possession is 90% of ownership.
Yeah, maybe make it 99.9. I'd go along with that.
She has two more here. Demand the U.S. exit the WHO. I really like this. The WHO is the World Health Organization. Ask your congressional representatives to end U.S. membership in the WHO. Stop financing the WHO with our tax dollars. The WHO, among other unacceptable actions, is using the healthcare system to institute vaccine passports, which is simply a way of getting the authentication system needed for central bank digital currencies and spatial control. There is a person out there in this space named James Roguski. He's on Substack. Read about him. He's the foremost leader right now in this space in talking about the problems posed by the World Health Organization. They're trying to amend global health regulations. And what are your thoughts on this? Demand that the U.S. exit the WHO.
Well, I can't help but have a chuckle and comment that I met the original WHO, you know, the rock band from England. They're a bunch of great guys. I got stuck in an elevator with them. I made friends with Keith Moon, who since died, an incredible drummer. But if you're talking about the World Health Organization, that WHO, the United States can belong to all the organizations it wants to. But the issue is we have a constitution and there are no rules or regulations passed by supranational organizations consisting of psychopaths and sociopaths who can write something down on a piece of paper or utter something that makes me or you as a citizen of the United States do a darn thing. The Constitution allows for the United States to enter into treaties with foreign nations with the consent and ratification of the Senate. Period. The end. That's it. They can pass all the rules, laws, ordinances, and little checklists they want. But until the United States Senate goes along with that and then sucks America into this global control grid, it doesn't affect us. So there you go.
Okay. And the last one, and you're going to love this one. Say no to taxation without representation. Regarding taxation, the CBDC is a way to implement taxation without representation. All of your federal and state representatives and everyone you know before you pay your taxes on April 15th, why we should pay our taxes when a $21 trillion or $65,000 per person in the U.S. is missing from the government coffers. It's hard to argue with that one.
Well, you're mixing and matching a real ball of wax there with a whole bunch of related but different concepts. The first concept is liability. Forget the form of medium or currency in which you pay the tax. Who owes the tax to begin with? Where exactly in the Internal Revenue Code, Title 26 of the United States Code, under which Subtitle A, Chapters 1 through 6 constitutes the income tax, then you've got Subtitle B, which is a state and gift tax, then you've got Subtitle C, which is FICA, your Social Security, and all the kind of welfare, wealth redistribution taxes, then you've got Subtitle D, excise taxes, and Subtitle E, alcohol, alcohol, tobacco, firearms. I think they've now got explosives in there, which is kind of fun. So where in there is the citizen living and working within the states of the union liable for a tax on his or her income? Where? Well, I don't know. Have you read it? How do you know? You're being conversational. I appreciate that. So the point is nobody knows. I mean, I read it. I read the whole thing. I read the entire 9,600 pages. Let me say that again. 9,600 pages in a tissue thin paper in about a 9-point font. It's called the Internal Revenue Code. I read it from cover to cover. And let me tell you, it's one of the most exciting pieces of nonfiction you'll ever read in your life. You know what's in there? Communists, bombs, explosives, guns, knives, machine guns, jail, everything's in there. Then you get to what they call the denouement, you know, in the plot where you finally find out at the very last page who done it, like when Columbo pretends to leave the room and turns around and goes, by the way. And then the one question he asks nails the suspect completely. That's where they tell you exactly who owes the income tax.
Okay. Anything else?
So to your other point, so, you know, it doesn't really matter how you pay it. I'll tell you a great story. If you like a nice story about paying income tax.
Yeah.
Okay. Back in the 70s, back in the 80s, a gentleman named George, I won't give his last name, was the credited inventor of whiteout correction fluid. So in the end of the typewriter era, before computers and printers came along, if you made an error typing, you would take a sheet of correction paper and stick it into the typewriter and then retype the key. If I meant to type a letter C and I typed the letter next to it X by mistake, I would stick that paper in, type the letter X over again, which would create a white imprint on the paper, which I could then type the correct letter over. Well, he created a fluid, a very light, you've seen correction fluid, it's very, very light, spreads on easily, and evaporates quickly and leaves behind a white deposit that you can type on. This is the guy who the IRS said that he owed them $50,000. So he and two of his buddies went to the IRS meeting, this is in Maryland, and they went into the room, it was all arranged in advance, it's all very formal and stilted and, you know, everybody's uptight, and he pulls out a paper bag full of cash. And it was $1,000 bundles of $100 bills. He pulled out 50 of them, counted them out, and put them on the table for the revenue office. He said, here you go. And then a criminal investigation agent walked up behind the revenue officer and tapped him on the shoulder and whispered in his ear and said, basically, not a good idea. Let's not do this, right? Well, under state law, you have what are called legal tender laws. If I, in the presence of witnesses, if I owe you money, and I tender you the payment of that debt, and you refuse to accept it, the debt has been settled, tendered, and refused. The IRS refused the money right away. George says, tendered and refused, tendered and refused. Thank you. And the two guys flanking him on either side already had affidavits filled out, anticipating this would happen. They whip him out. On this day, I did witnesses. They sign him and they say, thank you, gentlemen. And they get up and they leave the room with their bag of cash. The IRS goes chasing them down the hall. Wait, come back, come back. They get out of the elevator and they burst out laughing and all went out and had a beer. And then within a week later, a memo came out from the U.S. Department of the Treasury nationwide that never again could any American ever pay income tax in cash. And that's been true ever since. So I thought you might enjoy that story.
And don't forget to click on the link in the description below to download Gordon's free 33-page ebook on how to hedge double-digit inflation.